The recent release of the National Climate Assessment added urgency to the discussion of how to deal with climate change. The assessment says we are already seeing the effects of climate change, and those effects will only grow more pronounced over time if we continue with business as usual. Business as usual means generally setting something on fire to create energy. Even if our houses are all electric, there is a coal fire somewhere contributing power to the grid. We'll spend this hour talking about energy alternatives in a climate change context. We have four guests with us today. Buzz Thielman here in the studio with me is with RHT Energy Solutions. Buzz, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
We also have Alan Journay from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, or SOCAN.
Welcome delighted back, to be back again, Jeffrey.
Good to have
Thank
you.
Here.
Two guests on the phone with us from the Oregon Institute of Technology GeoHeat Center. John Lund is the founder and former director. John, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Toni Boyd is with us as well. She's the acting director at the GeoHeat Center. Hi, Toni.
Hey, morning.
It's good to have you all here. Let us start with just a little discussion around the table and then the virtual table at that as well of who does what. So, Buzz Thielman, give us just a little breakdown on what goes on at RHT Energy Solutions.
Well, RHT Energy Solutions is basically an energy engineering, energy auditing company, and we have clients from the Energy Trust to Bonneville to Pacific Power. And one of the things we've really focused on, you know, as we try to create a sustainable environment is, you know, conservation efficiency comes first. You know, one of the rules of thumb, if we said you want to save a kilowatt hour, it takes, you know, $3 to $5 to do it renewable, and you can do it with a buck for conservation. So that always comes first, and that was the original design of RHT Energy Solution. Recently, however, we started Oregon Energy Green on more sustainable projects. So anyway, I'm the president of both companies, and right now we're making good headway, and I've actually seen a change of philosophy with a lot of people about sustainability that I'm very positive about.
Really, change of philosophy over what period of time, would you say?
Actually, a lot of it, Alan and I were just talking about it, and what I see is education is very, very significant. A lot of people, you know, are going to put in solar because it's the right thing to do, but a lot of people don't know economically it's a pretty smart thing to do. The average solar system in the Southern Oregon pays off in 4.5 years, and that beats money markets by a long shot.
Pays off in the savings from using commercial power?
In a number of things. If you use the incentives from the City of Ashland, Energy Trust, 30% federal tax credit, you know, if you can use on your house the RETC, you use all those incentives and tax credits, and then you look at the energy savings. Pays off in about 4.5 years, Jeff.
Alan Journay, give us a little bit about you and your background and how you ended up at Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. You're the co-coordinator, is that right?
I'm sorry?
Is that your title, co-coordinator?
Co-facilitator.
Co-facilitator.
Sorry, yes. Well, I spent many years teaching ecology at Southeast Missouri State University in Southeast Missouri, go figure. And that was the experience that really energized me about climate change. I started seeing what the projections were telling us about how natural systems were really going to be devastated if we proceeded with the business as usual, as you described it a few moments ago, just continuing to do what we're doing. What I was seeing was just looking at the graphs, you can see that the natural systems just cannot tolerate the kind of climatic changes that are being envisaged as we go through the century. And for me, I happen to be interested in conservation biology, so I'm one of those people who actually cares about the lions and the tigers and the bears and the dicky birds, oh my. But even if you didn't care about those, my point is the same climatic factors that determine the distribution of natural systems determine our ability to practice agriculture and forestry. So even if you are totally anthropocentric in your attitude towards the planet, you should be concerned about the projections for climate change because they are going to devastate our agriculture and forestry as well. And then you add on to it the problem with acidification of the oceans, and you see our fisheries are look likely to be even more devastated than now. And I think the key point that you were making from the climate assessment report is the factor that drives me right now, and that is a lot of folks say, oh, climate change, way in the future, happening to them over there. But no, it's happening to us right here in the Rogue Valley. In the United States, we are in the middle of climate change, and the projections are simply continuations of the trends that we're seeing, the wildfires, the droughts, and so forth, and the lack of snowfall, which is going to have a profound impact on our water system, water availability here. It's all continuation of what we're seeing now.
But there have been droughts. I mean, there have been droughts in the past, yeah.
Yeah, but what we are doing is making these kinds of things worse.
We're just deepening the effects. And
that's right. Yeah.
Making sure that we are going to have to take a break right here, and we'll come back and meet John London, Tony Boyd in greater depth from the Oregon Institute of Technology GeoHeat Center. We're also talking to Alan Journay and Buzz Thielman. The topic here on the Jefferson Exchange is alternative energy in a climate change context. You can join this discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and 541-552-6782 and by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about alternative energy, renewable energy solutions that are becoming a little more popular and perhaps a greater sense of urgency attached to them as we begin to learn more about the effects of climate change going on in the world today. Alan Journay is from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Buzz Thielman is from RHT Energy Solutions, generally involved in the installation of solar electric systems. And we have two guests from the Oregon Institute of Technology GeoHeat Center, John Lund, the founder and former director, Tony Boyd, the acting director. You can join this conversation talking about alternative energy and climate change. And anything's on the table here. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. John Lund, why don't you tell us a bit about the founding of the GeoHeat Center at Oregon Tech and how long that's been going on?
Okay, well, Oregon Institute of Technology, as you know, started in some old marine barracks up on the hill behind Klamath Falls, and their heating bill became so large that the president at that time, Winston Pervine, started looking around because he was aware geothermal existed in the basin, located a site where he noticed the snow melting sooner in the morning before the sun came up, drilled some wells, and hit 190-degree water, and that water, since about the 1962, has been used to heat campus, and it's our only source of heat, saving about $1 million a year in heating costs. So we're sort of unique from that point of view. More recently, the campus has installed three power plants, adding up to about 2 megawatts, and a solar array that occupies about 9 acres that also provides about 2 megawatts worth of electric power. So the campus now is entirely renewable energy independent, and we're probably the only campus in the world that gets all of their renewable energy directly on campus.
So there's nothing coming in from the grid, anything like that?
No. In fact, we'll be selling some. Well, I have to add that the solar array is run by a commercial company, and they sell the power back to OIT. But it's all being generated right on campus here. So the GeoHeat Center, of course, was established back in 1975 and has been going strong ever since then. We've lectured, written papers, put in projects all over the world, so and including the United States. So that's been a lot of fun doing, and I think I've seen a lot of changes in geothermal energy, because electricity started being generated back around the turn of the century. Direct use, i.e. swimming, bathing, greenhouses, agriculture, has been going on for centuries.
So, Tony Boyd, the way John Lund describes it, I mean, the uses for geothermal are changing, but the basic idea is pretty much as old as the Earth itself, isn't it? You got hot rocks underground. Can you kind of walk us through what is underneath Klamath Falls that makes all this possible and where it is possible in other parts of the world?
Well, okay. Of course, the heat, what we use is the hot, is the water that's been heated by radioactivity deep within the Earth. And that hot water migrates up to the surface along faults and fissures. In the Klamath Basin, we're in the Basin and Range geologic province, so there are major fault systems on either side of the basin that this hot water migrates up along, and then we drill into it and tap into it. So there are about 600 wells in town that tap into this fault system, producing water, heating homes, heating schools, melting snow. We make beer here in town. We did pasteurized milk. We have greenhouses in town. We raise tropical fish out the edge of town. So there are all kinds of potential uses, but you have to have this geologic structure. And, of course, most of the geothermal exists in the western U.S. Because of the recent volcanism in this area. But the other use of geothermal is geothermal heat pumps, which can be used anywhere in the world. This just requires a normal temperature anywhere between 30 and 90 degrees Fahrenheit, drilling shallow wells up to maybe 300 feet to both provide both heating and cooling. A lot of that's done in the eastern United States.
You mentioned volcanism, Tony. I think a lot of people work on the assumption that because volcanoes are nearby, this is why Klamath Falls has geothermal. Is that always the connection, or are we making too much of that connection?
Well, obviously those are the surface manifestations that we identify geothermal, but in many areas they've drilled down to where there isn't any volcanism, but have found local groundwater that is heated by some mechanism, usually through radioactive uranium, potassium, thorium, that sort of thing. But no, it doesn't have to have volcanic. But there are a number of areas, like San Bernardino, uses geothermal, and you don't see any volcanoes down in that area.
All right, you mentioned just now the change in technology, the improvements in geothermal technology. I want to turn to Buzz Thielman at RHT Energy Solutions, though, to talk about solar electric. I mean, you've been at this for a fair number of years, I gather.
Yes, we have. We actually installed on our original building at 315 Boardman, actually one of the first arrays they had seen in the city of Medford. And since then, it's interesting. That first one went in 2008. Then we put our next one in 2012. And, Jeff, the price dropped in half.
Did it really?
It dropped in half. And one of the things I know it was a goal of the Obama administration was to see the price per watt less than a buck. And it has. It is less than a buck. That goal has been met. And myself as a consumer and as a solar advocate was really, really happy to see that, because that made the payback so much better. You know, I always looked at the people interested in solar and renewable, three categories. One category, they want to do it, and let's say 25% of the people want to do it because it's the right thing. They know there's a carbon offset, they want to do that. Then there's another group that said for the economics, and the first question is, what's my payback? But then there's the majority of the group, and I put myself in that category. I have to have both. I want to do the right thing, but I'm just not affluent enough to do something that I can't afford. And so when I saw the price dropped in half, Jeff, that made it available for the average person, which I considered myself. So I was really, really happy to see that drop in price.
Why did it drop?
Well, one is the competition of the panels and the technology. When you look what's happened, I really thought that thin film solar was going to dominate. But you look what's happening on polycrystalline, either mono or poly, the price has just plummeted. And part of it's competition with China. But it's a worldwide thing. I mean, we have panels that are made in the United States, such as Solar World and Sanyo and Sharp, that are right down there with the price of ones from China. So it's within everybody's reach at this point in time.
With any renewable energy, as has been pointed out many times, and this is, we have obviously solar, electric, and geothermal represented in this discussion, the prices become more attractive, or they become better as the price of fossil fuel goes up. Alan Journay, as the member of a climate action group, I mean, what sorts of systems do you support for trying to make renewables more affordable for the folks to get adapted to them, and perhaps make even the fossil fuels less attractive by making them higher in price?
Well, I think on the one hand, what we should be doing, and Buzz was alluding to this, what we should be doing is whatever we can to stimulate the consumer to invest in solar, wind, which means we should be investing whatever subsidies we have in those kinds of energies. It makes no sense to me that we are currently providing huge subsidies to fossil fuel corporations, which we all know are the source of the major problems destroying the climate. And yet they're not only destroying the climate for future generations and the planet for future generations, they're also getting huge tax subsidies. So we are subsidizing our own demise, if you like, which makes no sense to me. So I'm very much in favor of adjusting subsidies.
Can I jump in a little bit?
Sure.
I think it's fascinating what he just said because, you know, one of the knocks against solar, you'll have people come and say, well, it wouldn't even be cost effective if it wasn't for the subsidies. And I pause for a second and I said, you know, there has never been an energy form brought to the United States that wasn't subsidized. We can go back to 1939, the Rural Electrification Act. You can look at BPA, TVA. But you know what the biggest one? Subsidized? Oil companies. Oil companies have had more subsidy. And actually, an electric panel will generate enough energy by its third year to pay for its own construction. And that's something people always say, it never creates enough energy to pay for its construction. That's false. In 3 years, it creates enough energy to pay for its own construction. So I'm with Alan 100% on that. You know, we need to support it with subsidies like we have other fuel forms and put it on a parallel. And right now, it's competitive.
And that's the big thing for me, the level playing field.
Yes.
Because at the moment, because of those subsidies, these kinds of renewable energies, more benign energies. There's no such thing as a totally benign energy source, and we do have to understand that. So there are always some kinds of costs associated with them, but we have to support those that are the best.
We are talking about renewable energy on the Jefferson Exchange in a climate change context. Alan Journay is from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Buzz Thielman here in the studio as well from RHT Energy Solutions, which is involved in solar electric installations. And we have with us from Klamath Falls, from the Oregon Institute of Technology GeoHeat Center, John Lund, the founder and former director, and Tony Boyd, the acting director. You can join this conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let me get back to you, Alan, about you just said there's no totally benign energy source.
Well, yes, indeed. Even if you just look at where the materials come from, they're always going to take energy to construct the solar panels, to construct the wind turbines. And when you put large arrays of solar panels out in the desert, it compromises the habitat for desert tortoises or whatever. And the same thing with wind turbines. They take up a lot of space, and there is some kind of a cost in terms of birds flying into them, although the evidence suggests that far fewer birds are actually killed by turbines than by our own buildings. So there are costs, and I think it's silly for us to pretend there is such a thing as a free lunch. There isn't. We just need to recognize, on the one hand, we should be investing in the kind of energy sources that make the most sense, and two, even if we are all solar, all wind, we have to recognize that we should be trying to be as energy efficient as we can.
So let me bring John Lund and Tony Boyd back into this. As we talk about costs, I mean, what are some of the costs associated with the installation of geothermal systems? It sounds like when the original the president at OIT went out there and dug some of those wells, it sounded like that was a real low-tech sort of thing. But I imagine it's gotten a little more sophisticated since then.
Well, of course, the upfront costs are the big thing with geothermal, mainly drilling the wells, finding the resource. But once you have that, then the annual operating cost is very, very low. So, for example, I have a well in my own front yard that I share with a neighbor, and I heat my house, my hot tub, my domestic hot water, and I'm probably saving $2,000 to $3,000 a year on doing that. There are subsidies from the state of Oregon, the Department of Energy, that help finance some of these projects, but yes, the drilling of the well is the big thing, and of course there's a risk associated with that as well. But once that's in, then the annual operating cost is very, very low.
A risk in the sense of a risk in drilling any well, or the risk you won't hit something, or what?
Yeah, that's quite possible. In Klamath Falls, of course, we're in a sort of a fractured system, so you have to be able to hit fractures. And there have been a number of wells drilled that missed, hitting any fluids, because you need the fluids to bring the heat up to the surface.
Has the drilling technology really come along? I mean, as we look at, for example, how the petroleum industry is drilling for natural gas and oil now with the horizontal drilling in places, I mean, I imagine some of that technology would be applicable to seeking out geothermal cracks.
Oh, yeah. No. We use a lot of the geophysical techniques that that the oil and gas companies do. But, of course, they have a higher chance of success because they're in sort of a sedimentary type of rock that they drill into. With the fracture volcanics, it gets a little more difficult. But, yeah, we're using geophysical techniques that help us determine where they are. So, and they're doing directional drilling, too, to try to intercept faults. And so many wells are drilled vertically and then deviated, so they go horizontally through a series of fractures and that sort of thing.
Let us take a call. We have Bill and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about alternative energy in a climate change context with John Lund, Tony Boyd, Alan Journay, and Buzz Thielman.
Yeah, I have a question. This is a little bit off the subject regarding building design. You know, 200 years ago, you can drive, or 100, 200 years ago, you can see like Charleston, all the southern houses, and they all had designed houses where they had high towers or were designed in a certain way, like the our U.S. Capitol, that they create a chimney effect for cooling.
A very high roof line. I remember my mother-in-law in Georgia saying that's their air conditioning.
Yeah, and, you know, we've been away from that ever since we got electricity. And, you know, we got to build these back in because you don't have to air condition a house if you just have a chimney effect and pull the air in at night through the cool. And they actually, in Charleston, they used to actually a ring around the center top of the ring inside gas line inside where they lit flames to initially create the airflow, and then they turn them off. They like Bunsen burners around the whole inside of the chimney, which, well, the main center of the house. But I think that'd be, I'd like to ask his question, how cost effective would that be designed for chimney effect for cooling?
All right, let's find out about that. Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Why don't we bring Buzz in on this one?
Well, the word that we're looking for, words, common sense. You know, when the price of commercial energy dropped so much, common sense went out the door. And, you know, one of the things I found, just orienting a residential house to take advantage of our southwest sun can have a 10% improvement on the overall energy, just orienting it. So the long side of it faces the sun.
It's a little bit of a slant on the property, in other words.
Yeah. It is. Just having that orientation. But instead what we do is we throw the energy of it and we go for curb appeal. You know, so that has to be a change of thought, and that has to be a change in the consumers. There is a little, I think, a bright star on the horizon, though. And, of course, we work with the Energy Trust, and on commercial buildings, now they have, it's called Solar Ready, where if you're served by Pacific Power, Portland General Electric, and I don't know if this Eugene caller served by EWEB or PP&L's around there, but if they build a commercial building, they can get money for just those orientation. In other words, if it faces south, if the pitch of the roof is compatible with solar collection, if they put in the conduits. In other words, don't even have to put solar on it. Just make it ready, and you can get a check. Locally, actually, the harbinger for all this is St. Mary's School. If you look at the new NAMA Center there, they received a check for the Energy Trust just because they designed it solar ready. So I see a star in the horizon, and I'd really like to see that develop because I agree with the listener 100%. Common sense has to prevail, and we have to make those considerations in our design.
Yes, I totally agree. Totally agree. The irony is when we go back to the folks like the Anasazi Native Americans down in the Southwest Colorado, what we're looking at is folks who absolutely were reliant on passive solar design. Everything is south facing cliffs, and as Buzz said, we've had cheap energy, and so we have just forgotten all of the smart. And if you want to call a cliff a technology, we've just forgotten all the reasonable things that we could do. Designing a home which is very tight in terms of its leakage just saves a tremendous amount of energy, and it doesn't take a great deal of technology. And there's so many builders now who actually will do that, and it's really great. Building design is a critical component.
All right, much more to talk about as we talk about alternative energy and in a climate change context as well. Again, our guests are Alan Journay and Buzz Thielman here in the studio, John Lund, Tony Boyd in Klamath Falls by phone. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Buzz, Alan, John, and Tony in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about alternative energy, renewable energy in particular, and the urgency in adopting renewable energy given things like the National Climate Assessment, which shows that the effects of climate change are already being felt and will be felt more greatly as the years go by if we continue burning more fossil fuels. So we're talking about ways to avoid burning fossil fuels. Buzz Thielman is with RHT Energy Solutions. Here in the studio with me, Alan Journay from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. As well, from the Oregon Institute of Technology GeoHeat Center, we have John Lund, the founder and former director, and Tony Boyd, the acting director. For John or Tony, as we were just talking about differences in home design and ways that people can make their homes more efficient, are there ways in which homes are designed in Klamath Falls and other places that make use of geothermal energy that make that use more efficient? Are there things that about house design that are concessions to the geothermal, in other words?
Well, obviously, baseboard electric doesn't allow itself to be converted to geothermal. But, for example, my home, I use forced air. So forced air, hot water radiators, that sort of thing, lend itself very nicely to geothermal to either convert or to for initial construction. Lower temperature geothermal can use radiant floor. I might point out another advantage of geothermal is that we can cascade it. I'll use an example up at Chena Hot Springs in Alaska. In fact, my son's going to be working up there this summer. This is a resort 60 miles out of Fairbanks, and not on the grid at all, using diesel for their electricity at about 25 cents a kilowatt hour. They drill geothermal wells, put power plants online, reduce their electricity cost down to about 12 cents a kilowatt hour. In addition, they heat greenhouses where they grow their own vegetables. They use it in a chiller system to freeze a ice blocks for a ice museum made entirely of ice blocks that lasts through the summer when it's 80 degrees Fahrenheit. They also have geothermal swimming pools, and they heat the buildings. So they're now all entirely energy independent, but using it through cascading. We do the same thing on campus. We generate electricity, and then the wastewater from that, if you want to call it wastewater, then is used to heat the campus as well.
So in other words, it's being used a second time. You run it once through the turbines for the electricity and then use that same water again.
Right, and that certainly helps the economics. That helps the economics considerably and makes maximum use of the resource. And, of course, the resource that's pumped out of the ground is put back in the ground to be reheated, recirculated. So it is a renewable resource in I guess a general sense of the way. There may be some losses along the way, but it is a renewable resource.
You mentioned your son's installation in Fairbanks having a chiller. I mean, is geothermal used for air conditioning as well in Klamath Falls?
We did on campus. We did originally on campus, but it was an old style chiller. And it wasn't economical, so they did away with it. Now there are chillers that will use 180 degrees Fahrenheit that can produce air conditioning. And if you have 220, 230 degrees Fahrenheit, you can actually do refrigeration, i.e. make ice, that sort of thing. Not as common around the world as heating is.
All right. I want to come back to Buzz Thielman because we had a question that Joe and Dillard called in a while ago. As we were talking about incentives for solar installations, he was asking about taxes on them. Are there additional taxes on solar installations, anything like that?
You know, that's a nice thing about the state. If you put solar panels on your roof, it's exempt from ad valorem taxes in Oregon, and that's really nice. So a lot of people say, gee, I put this system on here, my taxes are going to go up, and that's not true. Instead, what we have in the state of Oregon, there is a tax credit. And it's up to $6,000, Jeff. So if you put it on your house, you can take $1,500, $1,500 4 years in a row, which is a dollar for dollar offset on your Oregon taxes. And then there's a 30% on the federal investment tax credit on that one too. So you add it all up. A $13,000 system, I saw one the other day, the out of pocket, you know, moving all costs for it, was $2,900. Went from $13,000 to $2,900 if you looked at all the benefits as far as the tax credits. Being able to utilize those and have the appetite for the tax credit is critical on the payback.
Let us take a call here from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about alternative energy, renewable energy in a climate change context with Buzz Thielman, Alan Journay, John Lund, and Tony Boyd.
And I certainly appreciate all these men putting their life energy into this wonderful effort. You know, we don't kill whales anymore to provide lighting. And what we're doing is killing the planet with this with coal and oil. It's ruining our oceans. It's disrupting our weather. We're going to have fires, droughts. It's a horrible situation. And the country really needs to hurry. So I'm so proud of these people for doing this. I'd like to come in a little bit under where they're talking, though. It's been alluded to, like the geothermal is not just deep well volcanic heat being used, but I helped a guy in the coal seam put in a long 4-foot trench that he ran water through and back into his house, and it moderates the temperature that they're using to heat and to cool the house. And I'm thinking also of a lot of things that are not being talked about. Like the IPCC report talks about photovoltaic only in terms of electricity production and ignores all the work that has gone on in terms of house siting, passive design, windows that pick up heat, a great plant. I have a great plant on the west side of my house that shields the house from that blazing western sun so I don't have to run an air conditioner. So shade, the use of passive design. And finally, let me just finish this thought. We're putting panels on roofs and we're using windows for solar gain, but the rest of the roof and the rest of the south wall is an energy resource that's not being utilized fully. And I'd like to see roofing that is entirely the south roof picking up electricity and heat and the south wall picking up heat for the house. There's a lot of what they call passive technologies that are sensible, common sense things that we could be using, clothesline instead of a dryer. There's a lot of stuff that we could be doing if we have the will to address this climate challenge that humanity is facing. We will find the way, but if we don't have the will, then it won't be found. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for that, Brad. Appreciate that. So, Buzz, let me take some of this to you because he was talking about making sure that you use all the roof, or at least the south roof, for electrical, solar electric.
You know, as we address things, unfortunately or fortunately, we usually take them in economic order. I was talking to the Oregon Department of Energy the other day, and I was saying, if we look at solar thermal, you know, in other words, heating hot water with panels on your roof and heating and creating electricity photovoltaic, what is the balance? Is it 50-50? And they said 90% of them right now are photovoltaic coming in. And even though the one is much simpler, in other words, anyone who's put a dark hose on their lawn realizes in the sunny day that it's going to heat up. It's so simple, but why? And the reason is straight economics, is there's a lot of copper in the thermal ones, and copper, unfortunately, has gone high, where if I look at poly and monocrystalline, the prices have dropped like a rock. And so if I look at you and somebody says, you know, what's my best return on investment right now? I've got to be honest with them and say that the photovoltaic is your best spin right now. But I'm not going to discount anything the listener said. And it gets back to common sense. And even what Alan said is we have just lost somehow in the whole thing, have just with the cheap energy, common sense design in our homes and our businesses. And that's why I'm happy to see the Energy Trust of the new building program have money available for people just to make it a solar-ready design. I think that's a step. You know, something, Jeff, that's interesting. I remember reading about the British Navy, and then when they first had a problem with scurvy, it took them 200 years to put oranges on the ship.
Wow. And hence resulting in the name Limeys for British sailors down the road.
That's great.
Thank you.
try not to take it personally, Alan. Before we forget, because I keep passing over this, there is a SOCAN special topic coming up about rogue solar, about increasing solar installation throughout the valley. This is coming up a week from tonight, Alan. Is that right? At 6 o'clock?
That's correct. On Tuesday, Rogue Solar, which is a program that Buzz is very familiar with, has been active in the valley for several years. And Tom McDowell, who's with RHD Energy Solutions, is coming to the next Southern Oregon Climate Action Now meeting to do our special topic on rogue solar and what it's been bringing to the valley. So we would really encourage folks who are concerned and interested in the whole question of solar energy to come and listen to Tom talk about rogue solar, because it's a very effective program for helping people get solar on their residences and their commercial enterprises.
Okay, Rogue Solar at the Medford Library Carpenter Room next Tuesday, the 27th, at 6 o'clock.
That's correct.
We have an email from John in Arcata with two related questions. One, what level of damage do guests think climate change will cause in the U.S. every year? I heard Hurricane Sandy alone was $75 billion. Two, it seems logical to me that this damage should be paid for by a fee on carbon dioxide emissions. How much would that be per ton of carbon dioxide? This seems like right up your alley, Alan.
Well, I totally agree with the idea that we should be placing a fee on carbon pollution. It makes no sense that we are allowing ourselves, which is where it boils down to, we're allowing ourselves to continue with this free energy, cheap energy, which is based on utilities being able to pump pollution, carbon pollution, to the atmosphere without paying anything for it. You know, we don't allow people to pump toxins into our water and into our air. Otherwise, carbon dioxide, on the other hand, there's no charge for it, and it just doesn't make any sense. I totally agree with the idea that we should be placing a fee on that pollution, which is commensurate with the social cost of carbon, which has been calculated by the Office of Management and Budget. I think it's probably a bit low, but about $37 a ton, I think, of carbon dioxide. So we need to start making that charge. We should be charging ourselves for it. It's one of those things we should agree we should do.
Bit of a non-starter in the current congressional climate. Probably isn't going to change through this year because it's an election year. Tony Boyd, a question from Catherine in Talent, wants to know how geothermal installations prevent hard water buildup in pipes. Is that an ongoing maintenance issue for geothermal systems? Tony or John?
Yeah, Tony, are you talking?
I think we lost Tony.
Yeah, I think we lost her. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, are you on again, Tony? Okay, well, I guess she's on the other phone. Yeah, that can be a problem, but we can treat water, or in many cases we put a heat exchanger in, a plate heat exchanger, to isolate the geothermal water from the house or the building system. So that's one way of taking care of it, or inhibitors as well. I guess, Tony, you just lost it. One of the things I wanted to talk about is information. We are hosting the Geothermal Resources Council annual meeting in Portland this year, which is papers on all aspects of geothermal energy, and then Tony will be leading a field trip from Portland down to Klamath Falls, looking at various geothermal sites in Klamath Falls and on the way down and back up again. So that's occurring in late September, early October in Portland at the convention center there. So that's a place where people can get additional information on geothermal.
That's the Geothermal Council, you said, meeting in Portland?
Yeah, Geothermal Resources Council, of which Tony's on the board of directors. I'm sorry, she must have just lost the connection completely here.
Okay. I want to, before we're finished with you, I want to find out, we had talked about some of the credits and incentives that are there for solar electric installations. Are some of the same, and I think you mentioned some of this before, but are some of the same credits available for the installation of geothermal systems?
Yes. From the State Department of Energy, there are, I don't remember exactly what the credits are, but there are tax credits, and there were federal tax credits, and I think they still exist as well for installing geothermal systems.
All right, let's put a final call in for Skeeter and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hiya. Thanks for the great information. I want to throw into the mix also the possible uses of wave power to generate electricity. I think the Chinese for a long time have been capturing methane from their neighborhood compost digesters and using the methane to power their buses. There's also the options for using low-head hydro. And I'm also wondering if there are any companies that are taking advantage of pedal power and creating family-sized vehicles that would have electric motor backup for going up the, you know, hills here and there. But I think there's all kinds of great options, and I really appreciate it. And do you all have any suggestions on books that maybe talk about a possible earth-friendly future, integrating all of these possible options into a happy future for all of us.
All right, book recommend. Thank you, Skeeter. Appreciate it. Alan, anything you're aware of?
Well, the one that strikes me immediately is Lester Brown with the World Watch Institute has written several books which are very very conscious of the whole problem. And I think they're called Plan B, so have a look for that. I think it's Lester Brown.
All right. And just quickly, the idea he had, though, I mean, are we really talking about personal levels of output as well? I mean, alternative energy coming from the human body?
I think that would be very difficult to actually power a vehicle on the basis of pedal power.
A family-sized vehicle, I think, yeah, well, that could be a problem.
But it's really interesting. I saw a bicycle developed by MIT which recovers the regenerative energy from slowing down into this disc on the back. And all of a sudden, I mean, it's a real thing.
Like a flywheel kind of
thing? It is. It's like a flywheel idea, but it recaptures that energy. And, you know, also on the methane, you know, here in Medford, we're generating about 2 megawatts right off the city landfill out there just on methane, and it peaks in about 20 years. So that's being done.
Always something new to talk about with renewable energy. Buzz Thielman, Alan Jornet here in the studio. Thank you. John Lund and Tony Boyd in Klamath Falls, thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we will talk about an outlook on the Southern Oregon economy. Our Vents Day segment will focus on today's election in Oregon. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll meet the author of What to Talk About. And that's what we'll talk about tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern, student assistant Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.